Hello, and welcome to the Cosmic Citizen Radio Broadcast once again. This is Andre Traversa. With me is my co-host and lovely assistant, Paula Thompson. Paula, I love to scare you by, calling in late and needing... I hope I didn't give you a panic attack this morning, did I?
No, I have Dr. Josser with her, and I was just with us, and I was just telling him that Andre likes to do this to me.
I do. Well, let's get started because we've got a lot to cover today. We have two guests on the show, and let me just reiterate to our audience that we are continuing our Outside the Box series. And that is a series of shows where we are talking to people who are not directly affiliated with the Urantia community or not directly involved in the reading of the Urantia Revelation. These are simply people that I believe are on the cutting edge of science, religion, philosophy, cultural affairs, things of that nature. We have two guests with us today. Our first guest, we're actually going to be on at the same time, but let me introduce them. Our first guest is Mark Siljander. Mark Siljander is a former Republican congressman from Michigan, who served in Congress during the 80s at a rather young age, in his 20s, and then began to get a really strong interest in world affairs, diplomacy, things like that, and has written a fascinating book that I just started reading yesterday and really thrilled with it. It's called A Deadly Misunderstanding, One Congressman's Quest to Bridge the Christian-Muslim Divide. Mr. Siljander, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Andre, great being with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, Mr. Siljander is only going to be able to be with us for half an hour today, but I found his book so fascinating that we're going to try to reschedule an interview with him in the near future. But in addition to Mr. Siljander, we have Dr. Zudi Jasser. Dr. Jasser is a Muslim himself, a self-proclaimed moderate Muslim who is also the creator of a documentary that is available online. It's called The Third Jihad. You can see that at thethirdjihad.com. And Dr. Jasser is particularly concerned about radical infiltration of the mosques in America by radical Muslims, but he is speaking out against it as a Muslim himself. Dr. Jasser, welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Thanks for having me, Andre.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, I don't know where to begin here. I guess I want to start with you, Mark, because I guess what really struck me about your book is that you for a long time have been an evangelical Christian. And you were kind of saturated with, I guess, for lack of a better term, would be anti-Muslim propaganda. For a long time, you thought that Islam was an evil religion, that it was violent, that it was hateful. And people were saying this to you in the 80s, right, even before 9/11 hit and that kind of thing. So what kind of, I guess, talk a little bit about what you once thought about Islam and what was the beginning of, you know, describe the beginning of your change of heart about it.
Well, thank you, Andre, and salam alaikum, Dr. Jasser.
Salam alaikum, thank you.
Shukran. Anyway, back in the 80s, I was sort of the poster boy for the evangelical right. Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Tim LaHaye, all the Christian leaders were all friends of mine, and I traveled on occasion with several of them to the Middle East and garnered an interest in it. And when the Quran was read at the National Presidential Prayer Breakfast some many years ago, I wrote a protest letter to one of the sponsors wondering why the Book of the Devil be read at the prayer breakfast. Well, of course, to make a long story short, they asked me, have I ever read the Quran? I said, no. And they said, well, how can you call a book by such, you know, name, describe a book of the devil when you haven't even read it? Well, I just told them I was just going along with whatever my pastor told me, and I eventually started reading the Quran, and underlining, I know it's not appropriate to do so, but what did I know? I was just a young guy reading a Quran in English and started underlining when it talked about Jesus, Holy Spirit, Mary, miracles, Noah, Abraham, John the Baptist, and so forth, and was really shocked about how the Quran reveres Jesus, even much more so than I didn't even think Jesus was in the Quran at all, let alone, I count at least 110 times, and some count more, but it doesn't matter, it's many. It's well over 100. And as a consequence, I began, you know, reassessing my view, at least of the Quran. Obviously, militant Islam, and I've seen part of the movie the doctor has put together, I've been to his website, I've seen Obsession twice, and don't disagree with any of the huge, massive threats against the West, and thought a little bit like that back, you know, years before 9/11. and thought that, that radical Islam would be one of the greatest challenges in the world. And I think it was prophetic at the time by many people who said that, and I think it's true today. But in summary, Andre, it's what do we do about it? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, you know, someone's going to come and they're going to kill your family and rob everything in your house. Will you just sit and wait, or do you do something about it? So I guess that's what my book is about an idea, another paradigm, if you will, of what we can specifically do about it.
Okay, let me ask Dr. Jasser a question, because I want to make sure that we have dialogue between both of you. Dr. Jasser, I'm really curious about this now. As a Muslim who is not a militant or a radical, in fact, I know you and I have spoken before about how you get a lot of your inspiration from Sufi texts and Sufi mysticism, which I think is fantastic. Let me ask you something. Do moderate Muslims like yourself, would you consider it desecrating the Quran to underline things in it?
Well, I mean, certainly any pious Muslim holds the Quran in significant reverence, because we believe the Arabic scripture of the text is the word of God. So simply having a discipline of being respectful to it is just part of that discipline. So similar to the way Judaic tradition would not put the Old Testament on the floor and things like that, it's similar in Islamic tradition that the Arabic text, now actually if you're reading it in English, that's not considered Quran, that's considered a translation or interpretation of it. So you can mark it up and do whatever you want.
Okay, did you hear that? You got permission now. You got permission now from a Muslim himself, Mark, to mark up your Quran.
Well,
I don't need
a very clean version that I use with my Muslim friends that's not touched or no bookmarks or peel over pages. See, Christians, as you know, Doctor, you know, we underline, highlight, bend pages over, stick things in it, because we have a more Western mentality of the holy books, where the Easterners, as you know, used to, the Hebrews would take the old Torahs and ceremoniously burn them after copying them carefully. And that's what I believe happened, frankly, to the lost Injil of the Gospels. They were in Aramaic, I believe, originally, and they were systematically burned when they become tattered and copied. And we have a 4th century version that the Greek people say is not as old as the Greek, but I believe it's a copy of a copy of a copy because of Eastern mentality of how to treat the holy book.
But yeah. Let me add something that I always like to find teaching moments in every example. And one of the things here is the intention behind all of that, as you just alluded to, is to maintain the scriptural sanctity of the text and make sure that it is not altered over time. So there is a significant reverence to maintaining every comma in Arabic. The downside of that from ijtihad, or in Arabic, as we call interpretation of scripture in light of modern day, is what happens is the acceptance of scripture as being black and white, which is true so that Muslims can have a point to start with. But what happens if you don't allow people to be critical and question passages and all these kind of things, students and kids, etc., if they don't start asking questions and highlighting and they're not going to buy into the logic and the rationalism. And one of the things we're trying to do at the American Islamic Forum is start to teach youth and give Muslims the freedom to begin what we're calling Islamic humanism, or an Islamic type of rational or reason, because I think that's really what ended up reforming the West and Europe, was that you had liberty-minded individuals that were, you know, Jeffersonian and Jefferson and Locke and others that were pious Christians, but did not want to be told by the priests what the scripture meant. They wanted to be able to interpret on their own and allow priests to teach them, but not control government. And I think there's a multi-pronged reform necessary. We look upon terrorism simply as a tactic. There is a goal in mind, and the ends that the terrorists seek is a theocratic state. And the only way to really defeat the source and fuel of terrorism is to change the goals and the dreams of these radicals, which are actually shared by many Islamists that are non-radical, and gets to the point that Andre was talking about, which is, you know, what's a moderate Muslim? To me, many people, I think, are oversimplifying this issue by saying that moderates are simply those that are non-violent and want to live peacefully. That's not good enough, because if you look at one of the rules that you can apply to this conflict is that every one of the radical Islamists that believe in the ends justifying the means, their ends comes from a bigger Muslim community, which is those that want to establish Islamic states. And as long as the clerics are unable to create a school of thought of Islamic law and theology that separates the domain of God from the domain of mankind and allows us to be free to choose and not to choose a religion or not and to leave Islam or come to Islam or to be blasphemous in our writings, all of that freedom is necessary in order that you really choose Islam as a choice. And once it comes into government, it's no longer a choice. And these kind of things are, I think, what ultimately is the fuel for that conflict that creates terrorism.
Okay, and I want to add something to this mix, because yesterday I went and viewed your video, Dr. Jasser, and it was shocking. I told Andre later, you know, I started out my day pretty good, and I went and looked at that video, and I got really depressed. And as you can imagine, why a woman with two daughters and a granddaughter and a daughter-in-law and many, many women, beautiful women friends in the United States, and I know both of you gentlemen are, you know, from the U.S., and you know what how different the culture is here towards women. It wasn't always that way, but it's gotten much, much better, and in fact, we women enjoy the freedom, you know, basic freedoms in this country, and watching the thing about your short, your 30-minute short, that disturbed me so much was the treatment of women. And this is, you know, this is typical. I mean, even your book, Mark, you know, you talk about the great misunderstanding, but even if you could overcome some of these things, the misunderstanding, textual misunderstandings, how on earth, without another 100 years, are we going to be able to overcome the way that women are treated in these cultures? And, you know, I mean, even take, you know, blowing up the statues. I remember when they were blowing up the Buddha statues, and everybody was outraged about that. But you know, it took quite a bit longer for anybody to become outraged about what was happening to women under the Taliban, who were, you know, stoning them to death because they saw an ankle or something. And this is what's most disturbing to me. And so I just want to throw that in there. I know there's no great solution to any of this, you know, at least not short-term solution. And a lot of things have to change for women to be elevated in the world at large, but to even a place of equality. But
that's why,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the way to do this is not only starting to create the ideas out there and spread them virally, but create a movement. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the, you know, the process that we're doing this is, you know, the video, as you said, unfortunately has a depressing aspect to it, but people don't start to move to create networks of change, ideological movements either within the Muslim community or outside it, until they feel that they really have a problem. It's like I'm a physician by trade, and when patients come in, the first step is always diagnosis. And I can't get them to modify their behavior in their diets and their medications or elsewise until they really know that they have a problem. It's often hard to just teach them about prevention. So the Islamic radicalism right now, or Islamism as an ideology, I'm still at the stage of getting people awake with sometimes with fear and other things until they understand that we have a problem. Once they understand we have a problem, I feel that strategically, as Mark talks about in a lot of his writing, the solution has to come from within Islam. It has to come from within a pious spiritual faith that shares so many commonalities. But if I do like the Islamist organizations in America, like CARE and others, which is sit with my eyes closed and be in denial and say, oh, Islam is great, it's 101, you know, let's give Islam 101 and talk about all the commonalities, and then they ignore the fact that all these organizations are very misogynistic and are still in the 15th century in the way they interpret Islamic law, we're not going to get anywhere in terrorism prevention, making America more secure, and actually getting to a postmodern Islam, which still needs to evolve.
Okay, I want to ask Mark and Dr. Jasser something, both, okay? The same question. Mark, one of the things you discovered in your sort of spiritual quest, if you will, was what you call the secret language of the Bible, which was Aramaic. And one of the things that concerned you, because somebody challenged you once and said, well, where does it say in the Bible that you were supposed to convert other people to Christianity? And you brought up the passage at the end of Matthew where it says, you know, go forth in all nations and make disciples. But there's a word that you talk about that's used, that is often translated convert, which I think I can't remember the word that you use. Can you refresh my memory of it? It's shalem, or what is it?
Well, very good. It's shalem in the Aramaic.
Okay.
As we all know, Jesus spoke the Aramaic language. Mel Gibson's famous movie, The Passion of the Christ, was primarily in Aramaic with subtitles, and many of my Arabic friends who went to see the movie could understand a significant portion of it because Aramaic is a cousin of the Arabic, and Hebrew of the Torah is birthed out of it.
Okay.
So therefore, the rich. I'm sorry?
Let me just. The reason I'm bringing this up, though, I want to relate this to specifically to our topic with Dr. Jasser. One of the things that a lot of the anti-Muslim folks say is, because I've heard people say Islam is a religion of peace, and the anti-Muslim crowd will say, no, Islam doesn't mean peace, it means submission, okay? Now, when you talk about this word shalim, and you say that one of the translations of it is submission or surrender, I guess my question is do both sides have a point in that particular can it have both meanings? Can it mean peace as well as submission?
Let me make it really clear. Shalom in Hebrew, salam in Arabic, or shlama in the Aramaic all mean peace.
Okay.
But it comes from an ancient tradition that in the Eastern world, when in these narrow roads and people would pass by each other, they'd show their hands or salute. It actually means salute. It doesn't really mean peace or submit or surrender or turn. It means salute. And that meant to show that you had no evil intent on the passerby. So it's like when we shake hands, meaning we don't have a sword in our hand. It was a salute suggesting we have peaceful, hence the word peaceful intent, and we would submit to one another on the way by. So the notion of salam, meaning peace, is correct. It means peace. It means salute. It means submit. It means surrender. It means to turn around or to go back to, and that's what Jesus and Paul used in the Aramaic. They never said you have to join a club called Christianity. They said you need to become surrendered, submitted, and turned to the one God in the context wherever you happen to come from, whether it's the East or the West.
Let me ask you that. This whole debate now between people who say Islam is a religion of peace and the anti-Muslim crowd who says no, Islam just means submission. Is that a false dichotomy or what's going on?
Yeah, I think if you look at the word itself, it's not a false dichotomy. As I was taught when I was young, Islam means submission to God, and the key is who are you submitting to. I think all faiths that believe in the God of Abraham believe that at some point you do everything you can with your free will. But at the end of the day, you have to, I mean, there are the whole concept of bad things happening to good people. You ask yourself, why does such bad things and torture and sometimes cancer and other things happen to good people? You don't know. At the end of the day, you submit to God and you say, this is His creation and we have to deal with it. It's all challenges. So salam means peace. Islam is derived from that word, but what happens is it has to do with your soul. Your soul is only at peace when you have submitted to God at the end of the day, but you can't submit in a fatalistic way without doing everything you can to do your best, such as take care of your body, treat yourself, all these kind of things in a way that finally, at the end of the day, when you can't explain things, you end up submitting. So the Al-Qaedas of the world, the Wahhabists, the Islamists will say that we need to submit to their clerics and to their imams because they know the interpretation of Islam. So that's where it's wrong, because Sharia, as much as I believe Sharia means the law of God, it's actually human, because the legal discussions in the Quran are from God. But once we translate them into human law, that becomes human, whether you call it Sharia or not. So it's all about who you're submitting to.
Interesting.
Well,
go ahead, Paula. Were you going to say something?
No, go ahead, Andre.
Okay. Let me ask you both another question, too. I don't know if you talk about this in your book, Mark, because I haven't gotten to it, to this part of the book yet, but a lot of people talk about the word jihad, how the word jihad has been mistranslated as well. Talk a little bit about that. How, and I'd like to have Dr. Jasser address that as well. How does the word jihad? What does the word jihad really mean in Arabic, and how has it been distorted in English, and so on and so forth?
Well, let me just hesitate to say don't claim to be a professor or scholar. I'm just a student of the holy books, and jihad, in my understanding, means internal struggle. It means strive or to struggle. In fact, it's an Aramaic word using Daniel. Well, Daniel, the book of Daniel, by the way, was written in Aramaic, and is called Jihat, which is an Aramaic word for strive. So it really is an Eastern construct that Paul used and Jesus used when he said it talked about true religion in the book of James. It says true religion helps the widows and the orphans and to keep yourself unspotted from the evil of the world, which is what I believe the Quran talked about, the big jihad. And there's defensive jihad. And in conclusion, I've looked up every time the word struggle or jihad is used in the Quran, and there's almost no places except for historical contextual applications of 1,400 years ago that it's ever used in a violent context. So therefore, my interpretation, I'm just on my own journey and learning. When I read the Quran, when I read jihad, I don't read holy war, killing innocents, strapping bombs in oneself. That is all a deviant interpretation and a deception and a twisting of what the Quran actually says.
Okay, let me ask you this, Dr. Jasser. Do you think Mark is correct in his assessment of the meaning of the term jihad? And if so, how come the radical Islamists don't get that?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Mark said, but I would say that the prevalence of the violent interpretation of jihad. First of all, I'll reiterate the word jihad itself. There are many. It's used as a first name for a man. I have friends with their first name jihad. So, the bottom line is it cannot mean. A mother could not be calling her son jihad if she thinks that it means violent, offensive war. But the other issue is that jihad, certainly in the Quran, in its 30 or 40 references, Islam is not a pacifist religion. So there are times in which, and as Mark said, in a historical context, one of the keys to reformation of these concepts is going to be to separate history from religion. And there are times in which there were clear conflicts in which God talks to Muslims, we believe, in the Quran, and gives us a dispensation, if you will, in which you, if all else fails, you sign a treaty with your enemies. If they violate the treaty, then, for example, chapter 9 that talks about, that's called by some the chapter of the sword, there is a passage where it says, kill the infidels where you find them. That actually is a passage that refers to a pagan tribe. It's not all infidels. It's about that specific tribe that violated the Treaty of Hudaybiyah at that time. And God says, you know what? They violated it. You have to be able to protect yourselves, and you may fight them. Now, sometimes I think it would be a little misleading to say that they were never offensive, that it's always defensive. But, I think a good example is the Iraq War. We did a war preemption there. I supported that war. Do I think that that was immoral? Absolutely not. But there are times in history in which people do things for protection, which ultimately is defensive, when in fact they ended up doing the first military incursion. I don't think that's an apologetic, but I do think now if you look at Salafist doctrine, there's a question of if you look at 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, is Marx's definition what most of them believe? I think that's true. But the issue really, you have to separate what most Muslims believe versus what the texts of Islamic law believe. And the problem is the probably 80 to 90% of Islamic texts written, which were spread by oil money throughout the world from the Wahhabi doctrine, which are mostly what we would call Salafist. Salafist in Arabic means those that try to return everything to the way it was at the time of the Prophet. And at the time of the Prophet, you had a mixture between the state, the military, and the messenger of God. Now, I think we can separate those roles that the Prophet had, but there are definite overlaps there that Muslims have not separated in our legal tradition. So if you look at Salafist texts, the concept of jihad, even here in Arizona, I can give you an example of an Islamic imam that's the head of the North American Imams Federation, and defines jihad as an armed struggle. That's his definition in there. So we've got a lot of work to do with the clerics that have, I believe, that are not really scholars. They are scholars of the Quran and Islamic law, but they are politicians. They are not spiritual, really holy, humble people. They are spiritual. They are politicians with an agenda.
It seems to me that people can interpret a holy book any way they want. And I've always found it very interesting that the three main Orthodox religions in the world, the Jewish religion, the Islamic faith, and the Christian religion, all worship the one God, the one Heavenly Father, and they all seem to be the most, I hate to use the word militant, but aggressive and competitive with one another, within themselves, and with other religions. It's almost like a form of cosmic sibling rivalry, I think, or something. I don't know. It's strange. But, you know, it's always interesting to me that whatever these interpretations are, we can't come to this place where we realize we're just little humans and we don't have everything figured out. And so, you know, but we're going to beat each other up and treat each other badly because my interpretation is different than yours. But I think with in the case of Islam, I worry that much of these interpretations have been taken and used politically to kind of incite a violence. But I think there's a cause behind that. And personally, I feel that a lot of the cause is due to some failed foreign policy on not only the part of the U.S., but on the rest of the world, who has kind of put Arab people in a box and not given them any respect in the world. And so they've left them very little choice politically except to exert themselves in this way. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, this is Mark. I have to leave in like 2 minutes, and I'll leave the doctor the last half to leave some of his thoughts. But I wrote the book, A Deadly Misunderstanding, because of just what you said. I'm a political scientist, not a theologian, and political science says there's more wars that start over religion than politics. And where people use religion, they use holy books, they use hadiths, sunnahs, and talmuds and other things to use people to pit people against each other. So what our struggle should be, our real jihad, if you will, should be, we should strive to find common ground that we can agree on that's so powerful and so new and so dynamic that will impact the very root of passions of the militants, why they're so susceptible to these political manipulations. So in the end, I believe that I've seen the movies and such that the doctor and his foundation has put out, and they do leave you at the end, yeah, very fearful, which is, and I don't disagree with any of their premise or the fear, but in the end, we have to offer some sort of hope, and I believe the hope is sharing the common ground of these new powerful discoveries, which we can talk about another show, that can bring us a lot closer together than we ever thought possible. And I'll leave the doctor with a couple thoughts. The three big issues that I've heard Muslims tell me that why they feel Christians are heretics or infidels is because God has begotten a son named Jesus, the deity and the Trinity. And there are others, but those are three big ones. And those three issues, I asked my Muslim friends, if we could bridge those three issues in 10 minutes or less together and agree as much as Christians do amongst themselves, what would that do, do you think, to the peace and the long-term struggle that we have to try to bridge each other? And they would say it could change the world, and that's exactly what we hope to do.
Okay, I know you got to go, Mark, but let me ask you, how do you expect, you can't really expect Christians, though, to change their, or either Christians or Muslims, to change their worldview and you know, for either Christians to reject the Trinity or for Muslims to accept it. Do you? I mean, how do you?
Well, it's a very good question, Andre. It's not accepting or rejecting. The title of the book, and I don't keep pushing, but it's A Deadly Misunderstanding. What's a deadly misunderstanding? I think that the holy books say the exact same thing. The Aramaic and the Arabic, the two holy books, describe the nature of Jesus Christ exactly the same. Not similar, exactly the same. They describe precisely what Christians mean by the Trinity, what Christians mean by the Son of God. I'm not throwing anything out for you. I'm just saying we have a deadly misunderstanding and don't realize we agree on most things, but our culture has inculcated our brains to think that we don't and we hate each other and need to fight and kill each other over issues that are primarily deadly misunderstanding.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to save that for another show because I'd like to talk to you more about that. But there's so much in your book that I would like to get to, and we can't do it right now. But we will get you back on the show soon, and we'll continue this discussion.
And we'd love to send you a book too, Mark. So if you send me an address or Andre, I'll definitely send you out a book.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Thanks a lot, Mark. We'll have you on.
Mama, and thanks so much for your time and your brilliant viewpoint.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alaikum salam. Take care.
Now, Dr. Jasser, would you agree with Mark that our foreign policy is sort of, in a sense, and Paula was saying this too, is sort of provoking or inciting a lot of this violence?
Well, boy, you know, I have to say that I probably ultimately, after I give you my answer, it'll be a disagreement. But, you know, the question is, in which way will you take it? I think that
it's okay. You can
know,
disagree
ultimately
on this
my main,
you have permission.
Okay. I mean, the question is you know, I feel the Bush administration has been a significant failure as far as their public diplomacy program, their ability to, you know, they continue to maintain relationships, which actually, you know, for example, with the Saudi monarchy, with the Egyptian government, others that they will say is pragmatic, and I will tell them, well, that's fine. You can maintain communication, but you need to still present ideas that don't allow us to appear as apologists for dictatorships and monarchs that are probably the main reason for the existence of political Islam around the world, which is it's been a theocratic response to these secular thugs that are in Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and everywhere that basically have fed this other beast, which is radical Islam, in order to keep the people at bay. And America has lost a lot of its credibility because we haven't. I mean, Karen Hughes should have gone to Saudi Arabia and said, you know what, I'm not going to wear a hijab just to honor your customs. I'm going to drive a car because you guys don't let women drive cars, and we are going to start helping women's liberation movements in this country. But no, we're worried about the price of oil, we're worried about all these other things. So that's, you know, that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, does our foreign policy, you know, certainly in the Cold War, there was a significant, we cozied up to Saddam, we did a lot of things where the Middle East was sort of a playground as we fought the Soviets. And, you know, I'm a Reagan conservative, and I certainly felt that communism was the scourge of our time at that time, and we didn't have time to fight all these different battles and in many different fronts. And do I believe that the concept of our enemy's enemy is our friend? You know, sometimes pragmatically that makes sense, but I think that we need to forge a new type of foreign policy that sets morals and ethics at the top and starts and stops doing this thing where our enemy's enemy is our friend. And the last part of the answer to your question is, when you blame foreign policy, you are absolving the people that use that foreign policy of any responsibility for their own actions. And it's no different than people that, you know, I take care of, let's say, that are patients that may have addictions to alcohol and drugs and other things and may say, well, I was abused as a child, or I was driven to this by my family, or I was, you know, I really wasn't educated and I didn't. I mean, it's easy to blame other people for your own problems. But the bottom line is that they can blame American money, they can blame American influence in the world, but at the end of the day, the suicide bomber is a corrupt individual that has twisted their faith, and they can blame it on everything they want in the world. But most Muslims I've talked to don't resort to those things because they are moral people. And I think if we're going to stop those things, certainly external influences have some role in that. But the first step to the 12th, you know, the 12-step program to alcoholism is accepting that you're in denial and acknowledging that you have a problem. And I think it's similar with radical Islam.
Wow.
And would you think that, in your film, I was really touched by, obviously, the treatment of women, but also the brainwashing or indoctrinating of children, very young children, into violent modalities. And it seems like, you know, if they've figured out that this is where you start with children. And I can remember back when I when my children were little in the 70s, my generation made a deliberate choice to say, you know, hate is taught at this level, and we will not teach hate anymore. We will take hate out of the equation. And what we have now is an inspired generation of young people who are ready to elect an African American as president of the United States, and I think that's absolutely fabulous. But it proves that we can eliminate these hatreds and prejudice, but only if we start at that level and start teaching tolerance and goodwill and acceptance of other people's points of view, and you know, just basic coexistence that, you know, it's really impossible for us to all see and think alike, especially coming from these vastly different cultures in the world. But I think that if we start at the level of children, we could teach them how to be tolerant and respectful of one another and treat each other with dignity. And I'm just wondering, because I didn't see all of your film yet, I really want to see it all, what you think about that. Do you think that it's possible if we start at that level, we might begin to make some significant changes?
Before the doctor answers, I just want to jump in and remind everybody that we do have about 20 minutes left with Dr. Jasser. And I want to make sure that if people want to call in, they can, and ask him any questions, 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. That's the number on your screen. Go ahead, Dr. Jasser.
Yeah, I think that certainly that's going to be the most successful avenue, is to put out programs and ideas that the youth, the Muslim youth, can start to absorb that counters the ideas that they're being fed currently. And, you know, the issue is we have, for example, part of our foreign policy has been to start a Arabic news station, television station in Iraq called Al-Hurra. And the idea is well-founded, but the problem is the Middle Easterners are not going to watch American media. It has the ratings of, the NASA channel. I mean, it's not being watched. And even with that, most of it's filled with sitcoms and things like that. Why? Because the government will say, well, we can't get into religious issues, et cetera. And I can understand that. But the bottom line is that you'll see in the film, the Muslim Brotherhood started a project 100 years ago to try to send its ideas through Islamic attempts at conversion, or dawah, as it's called, or education. They sent that out through tapes, through books and pamphlets, and you'll see at conventions, major conventions. That's still what they're trying to do, is just sort of tell about the message of, on the one, they present it as a religious message, but on the other hand, it's clearly a political movement. And I think if you look, for example, Iran, Khomeini ended up taking over Iran through the revolution of 79 while he sat in Paris. And before he went back to Iran in 79 to lead that revolution, he had sent tens of thousands of tapes and literature into there. So if we're going to win this war, we have to. One of the things the American Islamic Forum for Democracy is starting is what we're calling a Jefferson Project, and to counter the Muslim Brotherhood Project, which is to start to send the ideas of liberty and freedom, translate them into Arabic. And this is all going to take a ton of resources, and we're going to need help from foundations and others to really battle, because this war cannot be won with bullets. It's not possible. And it also can't be won by thinking you're going to convert over 1 billion people. They're going to have to go back to their relationship with God and feel a moral imperative to treat their brothers and sisters of all other faiths or no faith in the same way they want to be treated, the golden rule. And if they don't start feeling that, you're not going to be able to change what's happening. And clearly, you know, you talk about tolerance. I actually feel that pluralism is even a better concept to teach, because tolerance in many ways, yes, it's better in that it implies nonviolence, et cetera, but still there's a supremacist concept to tolerance, which is that, well, my ideas are better than yours, but I'm going to tolerate you and let you build churches and other things. Versus pluralism, where I was raised believing that Christianity and Judaism have equal access to God, have equally valid pathways, and there's absolutely no mandate to convert any of these people. And, you know, that's the type of Islam that I think we need to start helping in an interfaith way for the peace of the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's so many directions we can take this, and I guess I want to go back to is you talked about Sharia law, which is unfortunately there are certain countries in the Middle East that impose Sharia law, and the radical Muslims would like to see Islamic states I guess everywhere. They're even trying to impose it in parts of Europe, from what I understand. Where does that come from? What does the Quran actually say about Sharia law? I guess Sharia law is Islamic law. Is it meant for non-Muslims? Is it only meant for Muslims? Does it actually include stoning? What does the Quran really say about Sharia law?
Well, the Quran, you know, Sharia in Arabic actually is, I don't even know if you'll find the term itself in the Quran, but you do find a good portion of the Quran, if not over half of it, has to do with different laws. such as you mentioned stoning, which is mentioned about, you know, for those that violate the sanctity of their marriage. But, you know, then it goes into penalties and things like that. And, you know, the issue is, well, what do you do with that? If that's the word of God, then Muslims must, you know, the Islamists will say that, well, then that needs to be part of government. And, for example, alcohol. The Quran was transmitted to Muslims over 23 years. Some of the first passages permitted alcohol. Then the secondary passages years later said you should. They, God prohibited alcohol except prohibited alcohol at times of prayer. And then later he told Muslims that you failed and to drink in moderation, so he prohibited wine completely. Now that's part of Sharia, but that doesn't mean that Sharia should be part of government. And the issue is that all of us, you know, if you look at the Old Testament, there's different laws in it, and Talmudic law, there's large texts of the 614 laws that make up religious law for the Jewish faith, and those things are part of the backbone of law that an individual feels is part of their relationship with God. But ultimately, and I think the key to this whole discourse has to do with, and I'll use alcohol as an example. I, for an example, don't drink alcohol, but do I think it should be made illegal by government? No, I don't, because I think ultimately the best way to get the least people in society to drink is to do so through education and other things. But once you make it forbidden, it's like the child. Prohibition in America proved that actually that caused more of a problem with alcohol than when it was legal. And I think typically most laws are that way. You can't legislate morality. So ultimately, Sharia, yes, do I live my personal life based on Sharia? Certainly, my last will and testament, my marriage document is all based on inheritance laws that I believe are part of my faith as I interpret them. But the problem is you asked where does Sharia come from? At the time, we believe the Prophet Muhammad not only received the word of God through the angel Gabriel, but we also believe that he was the head of state, that he ran the first Islamic state. And what some of us hope was the last Islamic state, because, you know, one of the things I think made it legitimate was because there are some passages where God actually tells Muhammad and corrects him from errors he was having. So the premise, I think, from a rational perspective is that, okay, well, a religious state makes sense when you have God correcting a prophet when he makes errors. But once that relationship disappeared at the death of the prophet, and he was no longer getting scripture and correction from God, you go back to a human formula, which needs to be based on libertarian or liberty-minded concepts in which each of us have a personal relationship with God, receive the message of the Quran or the Bible or the Old Testament, and now we are on our own. And I think that's a concept that whether people think Islam exists or not, whether they think it's a contrived faith post-Christianity or not, the bottom line is that does my interpretation of my faith pose a threat to a offensive threat to the spread to take over Western states, etc.? And the problem with most Islamists that are scholars of Islam is that they have not reformed this concept. And the main concept that needs to be reformed is the concept of ummah. In the Quran, there are many references to ummah. Ummah in Arabic has two meanings. One is community, and the other is actually nation. So if we continue to feel that where God was talking to Muslims, that he's talking to a Muslim nation, then that's a problem. Because when I take my citizenship oath and I swear to protect the U.S. against all foreign enemies or domestic or foreign enemies, and I also have a religious book that's telling me that I swear to God that I'll protect the Muslim nation, then at some point I'm going to start to have conflicts with movements that are transnational that want to establish Islamic states, unless my imam or the interpretation of my faith that I subscribe to is able to say, you know what, the Islamic state made sense in the 7th century and onward, but after the 13th, 14th century, we need to reform that and say that that's history now, and now secular liberal democracies are preferable and actually, I think, far superior for Muslims to live in and really practice Islam in the way it was meant to be, more preferably than actually what is thought to be quote-unquote an Islamic state.
You know, Dr. Jasser, I don't know if you've looked into the Urantia book much, but And we obviously, the listeners and Andre and I, we both read it. And it claims to be a revelation to our world because there's a great deal of confusion right now about these matters. And obviously, they're so complex. I mean, you know, this idea of being free to worship God as you conceive of him and what you just described, you know, is a very complex matter. And people interpret these things all differently, and the problem comes in when some radical faction interprets it one way and figures that everybody else should see it exactly that same way, and they're going to force you to see it that way. And I have to share this quote with you because I think it's really poignant to what you've been talking about, and it's from The Life and Teachings of Jesus. Part 4 of the Urantia book is The Life and Teachings of Jesus, the full third of the book. It's like 700 pages, and this is from paper 141. Each chapter is called a paper, and it's called Beginning the Public Work, and it's from section 5 on spiritual unity. One of the most eventful of all the evening conferences at Amathus was the session having to do with the discussion of spiritual unity. James Zebedee had asked, "Master, how shall we learn to see alike and thereby enjoy more harmony among ourselves?" When Jesus heard this question, he was stirred within his spirit, so much so that he replied, James, when did I teach you that you should all see alike? I have come into the world to proclaim spiritual liberty, to the end that mortals may be empowered to live individual lives of originality and freedom before God. I do not desire that social harmony and fraternal peace shall be purchased by the sacrifice of free personality and spiritual originality. What I require of you, my apostles, is spirit unity, and that you can experience in the joy of your united dedication to the wholehearted doing of the will of my Father in heaven. You do not have to see alike, or feel alike, or even think alike in order spiritually to be alike. Spiritual unity is derived from the consciousness that each of you is indwelt and increasingly dominated by the spirit gift of the Heavenly Father. Your apostolic harmony must grow out of the fact that the spirit hope of each of you is identical in origin, nature, and destiny. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's great.
And that's, of course, you know, that's revelatory because I don't know of anywhere that appears in any other text. But to me, when I read that, it just makes so much sense. We will never all find an interpretation of anything that we can all agree on. But we can find within ourselves an origin of our Creator, that we are all His children, and that we agree that we all have value.
Right.
And we can honor that life. And I, you know, I suppose that's easier for me as a woman because I've carried life and I've suffered to bring it onto the world. And so life itself is sacred to me. In another place, the Urantia book says, you know, life is law and not the rules of its conduct. Life itself is law and not the rules of its conduct. And I understand that because everything that upholds life, that gives life, that brings life, that honors life, those things are sacred. And so
yeah,
the
I
things
think,
that... Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm
sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you said there really resonates with the way I was raised. I don't know that much about the Urantia movement and the book, but I will tell you that I think that at the core of a religious belief, in order for it to be genuinely a belief that you make by choice, you know, I think at the core of any faith is the definition of faith is that you make that decision willfully on your own.
That's
and for
right.
example, in the Islamic tradition, we believe in a judgment day, that God will ultimately weigh all the good things and all the bad things that we do and weigh our sins and our bad actions and good actions. That's why it's so important to me every moment of my life to try to treat every individual and every creation of God in a good way, because I don't know how I will atone or be made accountable for that. Now, to me, Judgment Day, if you believe in that as being a guidance of your actions, becomes a useless concept if you live in a society that's sanitized for you. If you live in a laboratory of freedom where you see people doing things differently than you would do it, and if you call it sin or whatever you want, if you see people acting in ways that you find to be, unfaithful for whatever faith, whether it's un-Christian or un-Islamic or un-Jewish, whatever it is, then it challenges you more so that you're actually living in a laboratory where Judgment Day becomes something where you can show God that you have acted in a way by choice. And to me, that's why in Ramadan when I fast, it is so, I was raised to believe that it's so much more Islamic to fast in a society or in a population where many people choose not to. And that's why, to me, the Islamists don't get it. They create laboratories of coercion that are robotic, and they've actually lost what religion really is.
And so often, and I think Christianity is guilty of this as well, to coerce through fear and intimidation. Obviously, what from your film, physical punishment is a horrible, frightening thing for a woman to be, surrounded by men and whipped or beat in a public place. That's got to be the ultimate humility. Aside from the physical pain of it, Christians use more of a God's going to get you, you're going to burn in hell. But still, it's a coercion, and the Arantxa book again says that the Creator refuses to coerce or compel the free will of His children. In other words, He wants you to come to Him of your own free will because you see His beauty, you understand His goodness, you want to be like it because it's the right thing to do. And that's about right motivation. And so, being a doctor, I can hear it in your voice. You want people to do things for the right reasons. You want them to take care of themselves, the ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure, because if they do, it's all going to be better for them in the long run. It's much harder for, a doctor to put scrambled eggs back inside the shell, Mm-hmm. It's much easier to keep them in the shell in the first place, and I think that's about right motivation. It's about doing things for the right reasons. And because you could coerce somebody or frighten somebody into a behavior, that's hardly a worthy motivation for right living. Right living has to be something that comes for the right reason, because it's the right thing to do, and righteousness is its own reward.
And yet, I will tell you that, some people, when they read the Quran, will see a lot of discussion in there about God's wrath. And they'll say, well, the problem, I think, in the Islamic world is that, often these imams, that's all they talk about. I mean, my biggest complaint that I've written about frequently is how many sermons Muslims leave just depressed about how the imams telling them how terrible they are, how the community's not doing well, the, this and that, and they leave saying, oh my God, we're all going to hell, And that's not how, you attract people through honey, not through vinegar, as they always say. And, the issue is, though, however, as, all traditions acknowledge, you only understand love if there's hate. You only understand goodness if you've seen badness. You only understand peace if you've seen war. So these kind of things, it becomes the yin and yang of life has to be there. And I think that, as a Muslim, I do believe that there is some necessity, and this may be different than what you believe, but I can tell you from the Islamic perspective, hell is part of the equation for those that reject God from a personal perspective, not from society. But at the end of time, heaven would have no meaning to an individual if they didn't know that hell existed.
Mm. Well, we do believe that someone can reject God, but we believe that if that happens, a person will simply cease to exist, because if they reject God, they're basically rejecting reality. So they're separating themselves from the source of their being. So we believe that a person like that will simply be annihilated. But that's okay. We don't have to agree on that. I know you need to go, Dr. Jasser, so I have two questions before you go, and make sure I get to them. One is about Sharia law again. I was asking you what Sharia law was in Islam, and what are the punishments that are part of the imposition of Sharia, at least as in practice, like stoning, beheading? Is that advocated in the Quran?
There are, as far as Sharia law, there's the personal, the pietistic Sharia, which has to do with how I pray, how I fast, etc. And then there's Sharia about how you deal with society and other individuals, and, for example, stealing. there is a passage that talks about, it's interpreted as cutting off the hands. And in Saudi Arabia, they enact things, the Wahhabis talk about severing of hands as being part of punishment. Now, there are other interpretations of those passages that actually describe those as metaphors, meaning that that's not actually a literal thing, but actually what it does is God saying that, you know, when you steal something, it is the hands that I gave you that give you the ability to steal. So I will sever those if you do that, you know. And that became, and that is a more modern interpretation of that. But I will tell you that, yes, there are punishments listed there, but the question is who metes out those punishments? Is it government, or is it something between an individual and God that will be meted out in the end of times? And I believe that those are not punishments that should be invoked by government.
And even the severing of the hand, it's interesting you should mention that being a metaphor, because even Jesus says things like, if your hand, right hand offends you, cut it off, but nobody takes that literally, you know.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Now, let me ask you one last question, Dr. Jasser. It seems to me, and I hope I'm understanding you correctly, it seems to me like what you're calling for, essentially, is a secular revolution within Islam. That what Islam needs is what we got through the Enlightenment, through which is a concept of the separation of church and state. Is that essentially what you're advocating for?
Yep, absolutely. Now, the imam in Arabic means teacher, so many of even the Islamists will say, well, we don't have a church. Well, they've created a pseudo clergy, and I think certainly the concept, the Enlightenment process, where the church was relegated to the church and universities, and that's it, and they got out of public life, and they got out of government, is basically exactly what we're calling for. Because I can see that happening in my lifetime. The reformation of Sharia, updating it and getting it into a postmodern, I can't see that happening in my lifetime. I think that's going to take 3-4 generations.
Wow.
Okay, and I have a quick question. Under the circumstances, do you think, and I feel this, I don't know why, but I feel it, I think if you took away the coercion element, most Muslims, even in other countries, most Muslim women and just people living their lives that, you know, that like me, they don't have a whole lot of, I mean, it's election time and we're all very politically interested in what's going on right now. But once the election's over, life returns to normal and you're not so involved. And I think that if you remove the coercion element, most people in their heart would be ready for just what you're saying. A lot less domination by religion and more just of a neutral, you know, they'd be on board with that if they weren't afraid of losing their lives. Do you think that's true?
I think, you know, with people with the same constructs as you that have an understanding of Western Enlightenment are not threatened by concepts of liberty and don't put concepts of Islamic doctrine above that, I would say that that's exactly true. But the problem, and I would ask your listeners and others as we leave this conversation today, to when they engage Muslims, to separate what Muslims would tell you as a minority versus what they would do when they are a majority. Because right now, a lot of the apologetics out there about Islamic law will say that, well, Islamic law is not understood, and when Muslims are a majority, when they enact Sharia, it is done in a democratic way through elections. But what made the West, and I have a problem with the word secular, which I understand. I don't consider myself secular because I practice my faith very, very much actively. But I do believe in secularist societies that separate religion and politics,
right,
which is exactly
yes,
what we're focused
absolutely.
On. And but that that concept is very – I mean, there are Islamists that call me an atheist because I talk about secularism. So,
right.
But that's ignorance. And – you know, I think that the issue is not about democracy. The word democracy doesn't appear in our Declaration of Independence or in our U.S. Constitution. And the reason it doesn't is democracy can become a tool for the oppression of every minority.
Exactly. I'm so glad you said this, because I don't mean to steal your thunder here. What you're really saying is that we live in a constitutional republic, correct? I mean,
exactly. And
we're not a democracy,
we're
a republic. And
exactly.
I think you're absolutely right, because that's exactly what happens in some of these countries. You know, we get them. We're cheering because they're democracies now, but they're using democracy to impose Sharia.
And the Sharia, what happens is they say, well, okay, we will impose Islamic law upon the Muslims and we will give Jews and Christians dhimmi status, which they say is a protected status of those that don't have to live in the Islamic State under Islamic law because they don't practice Islam. And they look upon that as another form of society, and they say that the West is very supremacist in saying that their system is the only one that works. And you've got people like Noah Feldman, who wrote a column in the New York Times 6 months ago saying, well, why not Sharia? And he says that there are enlightened versions of Sharia. And all I would tell you is the argument on alcohol that I was talking about before, the Islamists will come to the end of that argument saying, well, God said alcohol is prohibited, so therefore we must, versus a reasoned society based on natural law and reason will come to the argument that you have to prove to me logically that less people will drink or do whatever you think is wrong based on this imposition of a law. A very different way. One uses the Quran as a manual for society. The other one uses it just as a text that inspires reason, which is a very different method of argumentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jasser, thank you so much for being on our show. And I want to make sure that our listeners get know how to get a copy of your video if they want to view it. What's the
website?
I did send the website
out, but go ahead and say it, Andre, so everybody knows.
Well, go ahead, Jasser.
Yeah,
Dr.
first,
Jasser.
Our organization's website is aifdemocracy.org. And I'll emphasize that the documentary, The Third Jihad, was done by the Clarion Fund, and I was one of the interviewees, and then they asked me to narrate it, but it was produced by Wayne Copping and Raphael Shore and Eric Wirth. Their website is thethirdjihad.com, thethirdjihad.com, and you'll see people interviewed like Jim Woolsey, Bernard Lewis, Tom Ridge, Senator Lieberman, and a number of others in the documentary.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much again for being on The Cosmic Citizen. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, Paula, it seems to me like what's really going on here, and you know, from our perspective as readers and believers in the Urantia Revelation, is what it seems to be the problem with so many religions today is how do you transition from a religion of fear, a religion of authority, to the religion of the Spirit?
Yeah, that's it. You know, and you know, Andre, I gotta say, and gee, you know, I could have talked to either one of those men for 2 hours alone. I mean, they're both fabulous, wise, well thought out, and a lot of the comments on the board were exactly that. How lucky we are to have had two such wise men. They've really thought about what they're saying. They've educated themselves. They've done their homework, and you know, obviously, it's something that he said, Dr. Jasser just said, a lot of this is about education. And, you know, it's certainly about where we start. And I have always thought that that these things come through evolution. And I have always felt, Andre, that, you know, in some respects, the Western culture is a little bit ahead evolutionarily than Eastern culture. And so, you know, you can't, as the Urantia book says, you know, you just can't hurry evolution.
Right.
There's just no way to do it. And it's just not going to happen. And so, you know, that's what I guess what concerns me is because, you know, the Urantia book gives us a sense that we are, you know, in a bit of a dangerous place. We have the technology to destroy the world, but not the wisdom to not want to do a silly thing like that.
Mm. Well, thankfully, it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And that makes me think that maybe someone's watching out for us, right? You talk about not hurrying evolution. And by the way, folks, we still have an hour left, so if anybody wants to call in again, our number is 646-716-8158. We'll just be... we'll be here to take your calls, to take your questions, to take, you know, anything you want to discuss pertaining to what we've just talked about here, Islam. If anybody wants to call in, if anybody's had any direct experience with Muslims, or we know that there are some Urantia book readers who are Muslims. There's one guy in Senegal who apparently is I can't remember his name, but he's a really apparently a very, very well known person who actually talk to Muslims about the Trinity from the Urantia book. It's been pretty amazing. I've never spoken with the man, never heard him speak, but I've heard a lot about him. So anyway, you know, this has been You mentioned you can't hurry evolution, and I think that's one of the things Dr. Jasser was saying. Even though he's calling for reform, he says it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take 3 or 4 generations, he says. You know,
well,
and
I think we can help. We can certainly help evolution through education. I think that's what he's saying. You know.
Yes.
Yeah. You have to start somewhere. You can't just expect. I mean, that's kind of like the Arantia book tells us. You know, it's here because we've reached the ceiling with as far as we can go with the fourth epical revelation, and we need another dose to take it to the next step. And that's about that's about evolution, and that's about education. And the universe is educating us. We know that. When you read that book, you get the sense we're being educated. We are being educated in a major way.
And I want our listeners to know something, by the way, because I did not bring this up yet. I'm going to see if we can get Mark Soljaner to come back with us next week. But actually, it's very ironic because I spoke to Mr. Soljaner about our show, and I told him that we were believers in the teachings of the Arantia book. And guess what, folks? He said, "Oh yeah, I read that book." He said he read it 30 years ago when he was a teenager. He said it was given to him by a man who was 94 years old. He used to work on his farm. And the guy said, "Here, you sound like a fine young man. Why don't you look at this book, see what you think of it, you know?" And he said it answered a lot of his questions, but he said he forgot a lot of what was in it. But it was interesting because when you read his book, which, by the way, I want everybody to know about, that they can get, this book is available on Amazon. It's published by HarperCollins. The name is Mark Soljaner, Siljander. The book is called A Deadly Misunderstanding. It's very interesting. I've read about 75 pages of it so far. Actually, no, a little more than that, a little under 100 pages. But anyway, one of the things he says things like, Jesus didn't come here to found a religion. He came here to turn us toward, you know, to turn us toward God through his teachings, and that his teachings would have an impact on the human heart. You know, he talks about spreading the teachings of Jesus, not necessarily spreading Christianity. I was sitting there thinking, man, what has he been reading? You know, I think he probably, it's like Paula, you said, he may think he forgot a lot of what the Arantia book said, but boy, he really, it sounds to me like he's been reading something.
Yeah, I highly recommend this book for our listeners too, because Andre and I both got a complimentary copy, and we were elated this morning just saying, wow, we're loving his book. It's just well written. You know, he comes to his conclusions in a logical way, and certainly I think the Arantia book had an impact on him. I think if he read it again, Andre, I think he'd realize just how much, you know.
He was influenced by it, yeah. Yeah, I just think it's so interesting. It's such a small world, you know, when you find out. Here we are thinking that we're going to tell our guests about this show and this book they probably never heard of, and then we find out that one of our guests has actually read it. I never thought that would ever happen.
Well, you know, I have to tell you that in my many years of standing at a booth at public exhibitions where I've introduced people to the Arantia book, I think you'd be amazed, absolutely amazed, by how many people have heard of it, did read it way back then. And I always find that interesting because, you know, for me, it was never something like, oh, yeah, I read that, been there, done that. You know, not with the Arantia book. It's obviously a lifelong study. But I can tell you that I have met lots of people who said, yeah, I read that when I was younger. You know, it kind of hit that hippie movement. It took the hippie movement by storm. And a lot of hippies read it, but I think they were high when they read it, and they didn't get the impact of it or something. I don't know. But, you know, I always would it always did my heart good to meet these people because I'd say, well, gee, you know, how long has it been since you read it? Well, it's been a while. I said, well, you should look at it again. I think you should pick it up again. And, Andre, I get calls every day from people who say, you know, I read this thing when I was young, and I haven't looked at it for years, but I picked it up the other day. And oh my gosh! And Andre, I can't tell you how many times I hear that comment.
Well, you know, that's even so much my own experience. I mean, I got the book when I was 14, was into it for 12 years, rejected it for 10 years, and came back to it. So you know, it something you discover even at a young age can have a really formative influence on you. And I think that shows the power of the revelation to me. I mean,
yes.
The fact that I would come back to it, it has a force of impeccable logic. It has something that. You know, I think I may mention this on the air. I was hearing things in church about God's wrath and how we're all wicked, and it just didn't make sense to me anymore. And I started looking for a more reasonable view of human nature, and I started looking, you know, rereading the life and teachings of Jesus, and things that things that didn't make sense to me before started making sense to me again. I was like, you know what, this is what they're saying, you know. And so I think I needed to be tossed about on the ocean of life a little bit. You know, when I was younger, maybe I was too, the answer book was just too abstract for me. But as I got older, you know, it made a lot more sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, for me, it was it came into my life as the direct answer for a prayer for good news. And there's something so powerful about that, because the prayer was at a time of great crisis and great need, tremendous need. And the book was so, no, I can't even describe it. The only way I can describe it is I felt like I was dying. Like I was dying of starvation and of thirst, just parched in a desert, just dying. And this divine hand just came down and watered me and brought me back to life. It was such a personal thing. It was such a, you know, it was so personal that my prayer was answered in such a personal and real way. And the promise of Jesus that, you know, seek, ask, and knock. And the promise that there is an answer, and that I took that so to heart that I've never put it down. It was like, this is what I've wanted. This is the answer to all my prayers. And so I never was tempted to, you know. But then again, I didn't have anything competing with it either. You know, I didn't have a church or any other competing loyalties. So I was it was the be-all, end-all for me, and still is, and always has been. And not that, and certainly it teaches that, you know, it's not the be-all, end-all in terms of, you know, truth is relative and expanding and living and keep searching and keep going and keep discovering. And I have found that, you know, that with, for instance, with the interfaith movement, going to 3 parliaments of the world's religions and talking to men like we just talked to this morning, Dr. Jasser, and having gotten to know Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, personally, I've fallen in love with humanity. And we all have a piece of the puzzle, I think. And, you know, the beautiful thing about the Urantia book, one of the most beautiful things about it, I think, is it integrates all of that. It allows us to come together and see that more clearly.
I think you know, you said you fall in love with humanity, Paul, and I think that, you know, that's, it reminds me of the you know, the passage in the book, which is if you really got to know your fellows, you would fall in love with them. And I think that's what it's, sometimes our prejudices come from not knowing, from not getting to know people. It's easy to demonize someone from afar. You know, if you've never gotten a chance to know them, it's easy to demonize them and say that they're bad and they're inferior or they're whatever. But if you actually get to know them, you know, it's a whole different thing.
You know, and I think I've said it before. I think when Jesus said, you know, by their fruits you will know them, was another way of saying get to know them, because you can't come to know somebody's fruits in an instant. You can't come to know the fruits of anything. And I think, who was it earlier in the interview that said, I guess it was Mark Silgender said that, you know, somebody had said to him, how can you demonize a book, you know, that you haven't read?
Yes.
And we face this all the time with fundamentalists who say to us, oh, that book is of the devil.
Right.
And we say, well, how can you demonize something you've never read? How can you demonize a whole group of humans or a religion or anything that you've never experienced, that you haven't taken the time to know?
And that's what people did to Jesus. They told him that he was from the devil, although it's interesting because some of those people, you know, did hear Jesus, and they knew he was telling the truth, and they went ahead and deliberately rejected him. I mean, you know, Jesus does say that. So it is possible, you know, to do that. But I think in most cases, if someone really got to know Jesus, or someone really got to read the Urantia book, or someone really got, you know, that if they really, you know, if they really understood it, you know, they would fall in love. You know, they would embrace the truth.
Well, right. And certainly only through education. And both of those men we interviewed today are highly educated. I mean, they know what they're talking about, and that's just so refreshing to talk to people like that. I mean, you could just sit and listen to them. I could have listened to the two of them talk to each other all day. We have a caller, Andre. Hold on. Hello, 613. You're on Block Talk, the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, Paula. How are you doing?
Good. Is this Dave?
It's Dave.
Hey, Dave.
Well, Dave.
I just wanted to join in the conversation that I'm listening to here. But before I do, I want to say thank you once again. Every time I do call in and get acknowledged, I say thank you. But I think it's important to do. This show is just doing great things. Last week was fantastic, and this week is just as good.
Thank you.
I'm prompted to call and join the conversation because I wanted to point something out that is a bit of a concern for me.
Okay.
We keep using the phrase "the book," the book, the book, and unquestionably, this fifth revelation is a revelation. But I want to suggest to us all that it's not the book that's the revelation, it's the revelation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean we become aware of the truth, but it's not the book that's the truth.
That's right.
It's
the
book that's making us aware of the truth. The truth is the truth. And I think, you know, when we listen to some of the guests that have been on these last 2 weeks, what we hear is people who have found the truth in their own way, with or without the fifth revelation, that they've been spiritually hungry, and they've been on a search to understand, to know their Creator, to know their relationship with their Creator, and they make discoveries. And we who have made the discovery through the vehicle of the book often speak in a sense of amazement that someone has a similar revelation that may be an auto revelation as opposed to a sourced revelation. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is it's the revelation itself that's important. It's the understanding the relationship, becoming aware of this relationship with our Creator that's important.
It's God revealing Himself. It's God revealing Himself to all of us.
And our coming to know that fact. Yeah.
Well, as I said before, Dave, on the air, I think it's really... You know, I rejected the Answer Book for a while and came back to it. But I think this is a problem with not just us, but with people in general. You know, when they have a book that they consider holy or that they consider, you know, I mean, the Answer Book even warns about that. It says, you know, that people who, by the way, I'm hearing my voice in the background. I don't know if someone's got, I don't know if you got your computer turned up or somebody, what I was going to say, with people with holy books, people who consider a book holy, we can run into these kind of problems because it's very easy to idolize a book or worship a book. And I've said this before on the air, you know, the Urantia Book is not a substitute for a relationship with God. I had to leave the Urantia Book alone for a while. I came back to it later. But one of the things that happened while I was away from the book is I really got to know God. I really spent time in prayer. I really, you know, and that was really, really, that was important to me because only then were the things in the Urantia Book, you know, logical to me and sensible to me, because I began to realize, you know what, God can't be a wrathful God. He can't be a vengeful God, because that's not the God that I've tasted. That's not the God I've experienced. So the things in the Answer Book then became more logical to me, and they made more sense to me because I experienced them directly. So yes, I agree with you that and this I would say of anybody, true of anybody, not just with the Answer Book. If someone is constantly referring to the Bible or the Quran, I'd say, you know, it's not the books. It's, you know, what do those books point to? You know, and they point us to God, as they say I think it's in some Eastern circles, the map is not the territory.
Exactly. And I guess that's I just wanted to say that out loud, because I say again that this the Urantia Book, this fifth epical revelation. When I found it, or when it found me, it was truly a revelation, you know. Mm-hmm. But what it revealed, it revealed on account of my own spiritual hunger, you know, on account of the quest that I found myself on, hence the nick I use online, Questor. and it's not the book itself, and I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. I mean, for many people, the Quran is the source of their understanding, or the Bible is the source of their understanding. But when they start to lock their understanding to the vehicle, then I think we run into the problems we do. We lose sight of the what's at the other side of the vehicle.
I agree with you, and I think that, you know, for me, the essential difference between the Urantia book and other great and sacred texts in many ways is the fact that the Urantia book teaches you more how to think rather than what to think. And so I see it as a springboard rather than a something to crystallize and fossilize. But I certainly run up against some of your Urantia book fundamentalism, too, where people are very, very rigid about the book and very strict in its interpretation. And they actually get angry at you if you don't interpret it the way they do. So.
And that's exactly what prompted me to come online with you guys and just try to make that point. I coined a word in our study group here in Ottawa. It's mezuzify. And it reflects my understanding of what a mezuzah is, and that is
what is a mezuzah? I never heard that term.
It's a little cylinder-like thing that's used to contain a piece of scripture from the Torah, and typically it is "Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one." Or I'm sorry, I can't quote from it, but
that's
correct, the
I
idea.
Think.
And it's wrapped up, it's put inside this little mezuzah, which is a little container, and it's fixed to the door frame, front door of the house. And whenever you enter the house, you sort of touch it. And it's intended to remind you of your relationship with the one God. But what happens over time is it becomes a thing of worship in its own right. And rather than making us mindful of our Lord, just touching the mezuzah does the trick. You know, it's rather like the ring on the finger of the Pope. Why on earth I have to kiss it, were it presented to me, I really don't know. So this whole notion of sanctifying something that isn't worthy of sanctification in its own right, is a process I call mezuzify. And it's something that we are so fond of doing, you know, in our attempt to show our awe or whatever it is in this understanding of the relationship with the Creator, we sanctify things that make us aware of it. But those things aren't worthy of sanctification on their own. I guess that's what I mean. When we consider a text as the Word of God and therefore righteous in its own right,
and yeah, I think what you're really talking about is you're really talking about a kind of idolatry. I mean, that's what people.
Exactly. And we are wont to do that. You know,
absolutely.
You look at the great cathedrals we've built over generations.
Yes.
Representing our sense of awe over.
We have to be careful we don't do that.
With,
and I think what you're saying is we have to be careful we don't do that with the Urantia book. And I think
exactly.
People do it because people. I've seen people say that, you know, the. Actually, one person was telling me that the Urantia book is the Word of God. It doesn't claim to be the Word of God. It is not. It is the word of certain celestial beings who use human sources, and actually, and a lot of those beings are not. And those beings are not perfect, and some of us, in fact, like the Midwayers, are very close to us. It's like I remember Steve Dreyer saying once. He said, "You know, I have a cooperative view of Revelation." He said, "I can argue with a Midwayer if I want to."
Absolutely,
that was great.
This whole thing is about experience, you know, and if. We all had it right, then there would only be need of one of us. I keep telling that to people I bump into. There are many of us because there are many rights in the sense of gaining experience, gaining an understanding, understanding our relationship with our Creator and our purpose in creation. And of course you could debate, if I can use that word, with midwayers. You know, you read in the book, I don't know how many times I've seen it written, we don't really know for sure, but we think. And you have to realize who it is that's speaking when that phrase is used, and recognize that there is a lot that we are sort of not guessing at, but doing our best to understand, but aren't fundamentally understanding.
Wow. Andre, are you there?
I am.
Oh, okay.
I tell people, just to finish my thought, and then I'll get off my wagon. I love standing on my wagon.
Don't we all? What do you think? Hey, Dave, why do you think I'm a talk show host? I like standing on a wagon, too.
There you
go.
Ahead. Why do you think I call in? I just can't hold myself back. But I sometimes try to explain my relationship with the Urantia book to people who ask me just what it means to me in terms of my background as an engineer. When I studied to become an engineer, one of the things I had to master, if I can use that word, was the type of mathematics that supports engineering. And that is it's a subset of mathematics, if you like. It doesn't turn you into a mathematician, but it gives you the skill set you need to do the job of an engineer. So in my undergraduate days, the holy word on the topic mathematics was a text by a fellow named Kreisig, and it was called Engineering Math. And so in that book was everything I needed to know in terms of mathematics to do the job of as an engineer. So I use that by way of analogy to say in the Urantia book, there's everything I need to know to do my job as someone on the ascension journey. It's not the last word in ascension, but it's everything I need to know to get on with that job. So to me, it's a textbook. It's a reference for the journey I'm on, the quest I'm undertaking. And so that gives me, or that puts the Urantia book in perspective for me. And so I just mentioned that. And
I love that.
Said that, I'm done.
I think that's a very healthy attitude, and I think that, you know, Jesus said it very simply when, you know, the scribes and Pharisees were following him around trying to trip him up, and he and the apostles a hard time for eating grain. You know, they picked some wheat and they broke the grain in their hands, and they accused them of working on the Sabbath and this and that, and Jesus simply said, was Sabbath created for man, or man created for Sabbath?
Right.
And I think of the Urantia book that way, Dave. I think, was the Urantia book created for man, or man created for the Urantia book? And it's about perspective. It's about keeping in perspective what really matters. If we were not here on this planet, if God's children were not here, the Urantia book would not be here. So first and foremost, we are what God values. And the lesson is then to value each other, no matter what book we read, no matter what background we have, no matter what color of skin or political party or social strata. None of that matters. What matters most is that we are God's children, and He's living in each and every one of us. He lives in each of us. And so, you know, when we put these lesser things above that, that's where we run into so much trouble. Even the Urantia book is a lesser thing than the children of God. You know, it's only here for the edification of God's children. If we weren't here, it wouldn't be here. And I think when we mezuzify, I love that term. I'm going to keep that one if you don't mind.
Oh, that's why I offer it. It works for me so well. Keeps things in perspective.
Yeah, when we mezuzah.
We can put it in the. Make it official in a thesaurus now for idolatry. We can put mezuzify, idolize. We can put the verb idolize. We can put mezuzify as a synonym.
Yeah. Because it's sort of the step before idolizing. It's the impulse to idolize.
Ah, I see.
You know.
See.
There's something that seems to drive us to do this that in a sense is almost.
Well, maybe it's the sense of it's the fact that we want something tangible. You know,
I guess
we can hold on.
Yeah, we want to wrap our fingers around it, to see it, feel it, touch it. That could well be it. Well said, Andre.
And because it means so much to us, you know, it's
absolutely
it's a sacred
thing. Anyway, thanks for taking my call. I'll let you guys get on with your show.
Well, thanks for calling. Have
Cheers,
a great
all.
Day.
You too.
Okay. Well, I love that. I love the idea of masseusifying.
Yep. That's always a good way of
I think, isn't that in the book, too? I didn't mention this to Bro Dave, but as I recall, and we just read this in study group the other night, where Jesus was able to point that out to his father as something that was kind of ritualistic. And do you remember that, Andre?
No, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Yeah, the little scroll on the door that you touch every time.
Yes. He was talking about that to his family. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a child.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think you know, I just think it's human nature. A lot of it's human nature, and the beautiful thing about the Arantxa book and about God and about the universe and about the beings that we've come to know through the Arantxa book is they're infinitely patient with us and they understand us. They understand what we will tend to do. You know, the history of your ranch is so beautiful in that way because it gives you a sense of where your ancestors came from, little vignettes of their struggle and, you know, the fetishes, charms, and magic and the growth of ghost fear and the primitive concepts of religion and how that grows. And, you know, I like to put myself in their place. I like to say, okay, imagine you've been an angel down here for 20,000 years. What have you witnessed? How many generations of humans have you seen come and go? You know, multiple generations. How long have you been able to follow the seed, like you, Andre? You know, your mom and dad and your mother's 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 mother and your father's 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 father. I love to think about that because I get it. I tap into their love for us that way. I really do. Mm. I tap into them, and I get a sense of their long distance vision in both directions, which is important. It's not just the vision going forward; it's the vision of the past that they have.
Yeah.
That they see all that we've been through collectively as a race on a planet.
Right.
That their hearts are inextricably connected to ours. We are connected at the heart. In fact, I had an experience. I've had a couple of experiences with the angels where I cried with them. And, you know, the Arantxa book says it shares all of our emotions except, they share all of our emotions except fear. The day of the Oklahoma City bombing, I just burst into tears for no reason. And I was sitting at my office at Jesusonian Foundation. And it was about, I don't even remember what, it was in the morning. And it was, I know now that it was exactly at the moment of the bombing. But I didn't know that that had happened. I hadn't heard that news. And I just burst into tears. And I was sobbing. I was just sobbing. And my friend Luann, who was working with me at the time, came in and she said, Paula, what the heck's the matter with you? I said, I don't know. I don't know. And then later, maybe minutes later, you know, within 15 minutes, we heard the news about the bombing in Oklahoma City.
Oh, so you didn't know about it when you were crying?
No.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, I thought that is really strange. That had never happened to me before. It's happened once again since. And but I've thought about it a lot, Andre. And just what I just described, their past vision, and you know, there's a reference in that paper, the Seraphic Planetary Government, I believe, where they say they've been given permission to foster the spiritual types on Urantia. And because, you know, and they often talk about genetics having direct effect on your social outlooks and your spiritual outlooks, and they've been given permission to foster these types. And so I really pondered what that means. And I've pondered, as they look into my past and my grandmother and my grandmother's mother and my grandfather and all of those potentials that go into making me and then now my children. And how I learned from my grandmother how to treat people. What a dignified person she was. What a love. What a joy she was. How much I love her. What a spiritual mentor she was to me. They know that. And, you know, those seeds, sometimes when they've nurtured them, imagine how long they've nurtured that seed and they've brought it down through time. And it culminates in you and then it goes on in your children. And how important that is to the world, those loving and peaceful people. It's like they mention it in another place with the status of the later Jew, right? The individual Jew, the status of the individual Jew. And they say, you can't imagine how it has hurt us, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, to see the progeny of spiritual nobility, like Peter, be persecuted and destroyed, you know? And so I think about that, and you know, another time I was driving to work, and I was talking to the angels, and I was telling them, you know, I love my children so much. I just, you know, I know I pray about my children a lot to you guys, and I know I tell you to protect my children, you know, because it's my mother's heart. I just don't want anything bad to happen to them, and please, you know, please keep them safe because I love them so much. And Andre, I swear, I heard as clear as a bell. Well, we love them too.
Oh, wow.
And that was such an epiphany for me because I thought about it again. Again, I was reminded. And I thought about it. I thought, well, of course you do. Of course you do. You love them.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, Paula, because on the one hand, you know, they don't usually interfere, at least, with accidents and you know, to prevent accidents, and they don't interfere with our free will decisions, of course. But on the other hand, you know, they are watching over us. We're not alone.
No. We're not at all alone. And, you know, and I wonder, Andre, you just said they don't interfere with accidents. I wonder about that, because that MOTA that says blind...
Well, it says they normally don't, but, I mean, sometimes they do. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think it says they normally don't, But I think they use the word normally that under most circumstances they don't. But there are too many stories that I've heard about people, you know, having been spared, you know, through what they believe could only have been, you know, angelic intervention.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. But you know, I think, you know, it says blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. And then it says, this is MOTA 7. It says, neither do the celestial beings assist the lower being who refuses to act upon his light of truth.
Mm.
It's interesting that they put those two together. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, they say that because they do foster the spiritual types and they have been given permission to do some extraordinary things. I don't think they see death the same way we do. You know, I think they see death as birth. You know, it's almost like, oh, this child's ready to be born now. This is your birthday. They don't
That's
see it
right.
as your death
That's
day.
Right.
But if there is something, if you are a person who has a destiny on this planet, I think they will and they have done extraordinary things to preserve certain human beings on this planet. And you know, it's just really interesting. It's all, you know, one of the things I love the most about the Urantia book is it gives me an insight into their the way they think. And their job, I like to think about their job. I like to imagine, okay, if I was an angel and I've been down here for 10,000 years, how would I feel about this? What would be the insight that 10,000 years of watching human struggle would have given me? You know, I really do. I really try to see things through their eyes. Because, invariably, one of the greatest techniques I have for troublesome humans that, you know, in that, and by that I mean humans that are troublesome to me. I ask Jesus, please, Master, let me see this person through your eyes.
Yeah.
And invariably what he shows me is a child, a little child, who's afraid or insecure or,
right,
you know, putting up defenses of some kind. You know?
Well, it's like people, you know, I've heard people, you may have heard this phrase, you know, hurt people hurt people. You know, and so people, usually when people are very angry or, you know, something like that, it's usually a mask for something. It's usually because they're hurting or they're afraid. And so I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. You know, they're trying to protect themselves. And so,
right,
and so they feel the need to protect themselves. And so they, you know, they protect themselves either by being lashing out at other people or by being really guarded or distant or, whatever it might be, or by only talking about superficial things, or whatever it might be, you know, those things that frustrate us. You know, I think it's important for us to look at, to be able to look beneath the surface, because, you know, I think there's a place too in the book where Jesus talks about how the only way we're really able to understand and forgive our fellows is when we understand their inner impulses. You know, and you know, in a sense, that's what, you know, I think psychology helps us do, and therapy and things like that help us do. But, you know, you don't have to be a therapist to be able to do it. I think what Jesus is really asking us to do is to look at that person the way God sees them, and what that really ultimately means is to see them with compassion.
Yeah, and patience and value. You know, I mean, it's like the book says in so many ways. You know, it's not so important what you are as what you are becoming.
That's right.
Day by day. And if we can learn to see each other in that way, then we don't give up. I think that, you know, oftentimes it's a couple of things. We're hurt and we're protecting ourselves. And I saw a lecture at the parliament in Spain on fundamentalism. And the woman that did the lecture, and gosh, I wish I could remember her name. She's really a remarkable person. She's written a book on fundamentalism. She attributes fundamentalism to that. It's just a basic fear that we're losing our culture. We're losing ourselves. We can't let that happen. We've got to hold on for dear life, because this is how we define ourselves, and if we lose us, what are we going to do?
Or I think it also comes from the fear that if we let go of this, then we'll have nothing. You know,
then we'll have nothing.
If we let go of this doctrine, then you know, then we won't. Then our faith won't have anything to rest on. We'll have no foundation. We'll have nothing. You know,
right.
And I think that's you know, that's a fear too. I think that's another part of it.
I agree. So that's at the heart, and then you know, and then the other side of that is human need, what we need, and our needs haven't been met in many ways, and you know, we're just you know, as I look at how the universe views us with such care and with such love, you know, certainly we're dangerous, and obviously you look around the world. I mean, even looking at Dr. Jasser's video that he narrated. It's shocking to see the lengths we'll go to.
Yeah.
To, I don't know, to defend and protect our vulnerable selves. You know, it's like my friend Mary Evan, she used to joke, and she'd say, I love the Urantia book so much, I'd not only die for it, I'd kill for it. And, of course, she was just teasing.
What did she say? She killed one?
I would kill for it.
Oh, kill for it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. She said, I'd not only die for it, I'd kill for it. And then she'd look at you, you know, like, you better watch out. And she was just joking. She had a great sense of humor. But the truth of the matter is that that's a reality that many religionists feel. It's not so far-fetched that they'd not only die for their religion, they'd kill for it, you know.
Wow.
Maybe the, you know.
Wow. How are we doing on time here, Paula?
Well, we've got 14 minutes, and
okay.
We haven't had a caller in a while. So
now, if anybody wants to call in, please do, 646-716-8158. The other thing we could do is if you have a song we could play, we could do that.
Hey, did you like that one by Franzl?
Oh, of course. You know what? I want to make sure that I give a plug to that, too, because I occasionally forget. If anybody wants to find Franzl's music, you can go to Franzl.com, F-R-A-N-C-Y-L. That's Franzl.com. So if anybody wants to hear her, get her CDs or anything, they can do that.
Well, shall we play a little song, Andre?
Let's do that.
Okay, here we go.
Garwin, again, I don't know the name of that song. Can you tell us what that song is,
Yes,
Paula?
It's Gentle Healer of Our Souls.
I'm sorry, what is it?
Gentle Healer of Our Souls.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful?
Well, that's a good description of our Father, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And, you know, I got to tell you, Andre, some people are trying to get our bro Larry to call us on the phone, and they're trying to talk him into it, but he's hesitant. Larry, I guess you really are a shy guy. But
I told him, I encouraged him while the song was playing. He said, go ahead, call in, Larry. But he's telling me, yeah, Larry, come on, call in. And, yeah, Larry, you know, does so much and serves in so many ways, like so many of our listeners and all.
He really
the other.
Does, and I want to make sure, you know, you know what we'll do? We'll just really embarrass him now and just talk about what a great asset he is to the show, because he basically mans our whole website. He it really does all the behind-the-scenes work. He even I read the book, Mark Soljander's book, before I did. I mean, the guy's just on top of everything. And so what can I say? This is it's Larry Watkins. What is it? We love you, Larry. Oh, yes, we do.
Okay, well, I think we've embarrassed Larry.
I'm sure he's blushing at his computer board right now as we speak.
Yeah, he knows. So. He knows how we love him. And thank you, Larry, from the bottom of my heart for all you do. And
absolutely.
I've told you this many times in person, but it's really great to say it on air. And you know, we have a great community, and I feel so blessed, Andre, to know so many. I was thinking about this just this morning, how blessed I am. I was thinking about our brother Bay Sarmast for some reason, you know, because you had mentioned, you know, I knew we were going to be talking to a Muslim, and Bayes was raised in Iran until he was 11 years old and then came to America, and he is our heroic explorer who went in search of the Garden of Eden for all of us, and he is an amazing human being, and I'd love to get him on the show sometime and do an interview with him. I know that was, you know, the culmination of that was really a disappointment, because it was an awful lot of work and effort, and then, of course, they didn't find what they were looking for. But to me, you know, I don't care about any of that. I know it's there, and he knows it's there, and he had the courage of his conviction. And but he really is an amazing person.
And you know what,
I feel
so
blessed.
Great too. You know what's great too, Paula, that we have someone in the movement who's honest enough to admit it and say, you know what, we didn't do it. You know, it would have been very easy for someone to come with a con job and say, oh, well, we found it. I guess they found something, but it was natural. It wasn't man made. And so you know,
well, that was
very,
the determination.
Yeah, and it would have been very easy for someone to probably, you know, deceive the public and say, well, this thing is man-made. We really did find the Garden of Eden, you know.
Right.
But, you know, but he had the humility and the integrity to not do that.
Right. And but even his book was so well written. And I highly recommend his books to anybody that, you know, we know he's in the right area and when he's looking for the garden. And I highly recommend his books. And, you know, the first one that talks about the Samaritan text, we should get him on to talk about that, Andre. But for now, I think we've got Larry on the phone. Hold on. Larry, is it you?
It's me. Hi, Paula.
Hey, Larry.
I'm Andre.
Welcome to your first. It's your first on-air appearance.
Well, yeah, I thought I'd step in at the tail end here. I don't have a long-distance server, so I have to dial about 16 numbers on my calling card to get in.
So it's a pain. Is that what you're
well,
saying?
Well, anyway, you've had another fantastic show. It was excellent, and hopefully we'll be able to keep in touch with these people.
Yeah, I'm going to see. I'll just let everybody know. I'm going to see if we can get Mr. Soljander back on next week, actually, because I want to do a whole show with just him, because he's got so much in his book that is so... it's worthy of a whole show by itself.
Right,
not just because we're discussing Islam, but as an example of someone who is really trying to do some bridge building, you know, from an interfaith, you know, point of view.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, just Larry, you have his book, right? You told us, you gave us a
right. I read it yesterday.
Did you read the whole thing?
Uh huh.
What do you think?
What I try to do is read the book and give you my impressions in case you aren't able to get completely through it yourselves, and then at least you'll have some kind of a bit of a background to go on.
See what I mean, folks? This is our Larry. Yeah, he wrote us yesterday and gave us a synopsis, and he's done that the last few weeks with the books we've gotten, and it's been really wonderful. Thank you so much for doing that, because it really
well, it's
helps
a real
me.
Privilege to get to work with you and do this show in the background. So
you do a great job too. Thanks for the website. Larry does the website. You guys, he does the bio page, all of that. It really has.
it's really nice to have that, Larry. Thank you so much.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I'm glad to be able to help out. And hi to everybody on the discussion board. It's been very active.
That's lively, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, Andre, we always get comments, yeah, Andre, good point, you know, but it's not always easy to break in and tell you what people have said, but I just want you to know the feedback on the board is always great. So thanks, everybody that's listening, and especially you guys on the board. You give us great feedback, and we really appreciate that. And I try to get it in when I can. So just so you know, today, though, with two guests, I really had to concentrate on what was being said.
Well, you guys are doing a great job. I'm going to go now.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
God bless you, bro.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, folks. And thanks for tuning in today to The Cosmic Citizen. We will see you next week.